William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, and friend, John McKinnon, the author of The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. And together, we're discussing weaponized religion, how Christian identity fused with early Christian fundamentalism and politics to form the foundation for the new apostolic reformation. John, I feel like today is really the start of our episodes that we're doing on this. It took two or three episodes to build up the background for where we're headed. But as you enter into the early 1920s, that's really the epicenter of where all of this came to be. And to paint the picture, because in our minds, when we think of many of these groups that we're mentioning, the Klan and so on and so forth, we're painted with a very, Hollywood style image of what that is. And it's always, you know, the worst of the worst of the people. However, back during its time, it was actually really popular, and it was a very complex organization. There were many facets to, to the things that they believed and the things that they tried to portray and tried to convince Americans, some of which actually were good things. But when you mix the good with the bad, that's where you end up with the ugly. And as it relates to the NAR, that's kind of where the entire podcast is headed. You know, there are some good things, but when you mix all of the bad things with it and then realize that many of that has been covered up over the years, it turns into this thing that you really have to question: was this a move of God?
You know, Davis plays a large role in the subject of weaponization of religion in America. You know, he was definitely a key figure in starting the movement. It just went totally nationwide, especially after Clark and Taylor got involved with the publicity of the KKK and increased membership into the millions. And so he was a very key figure there. And once that new KKK was founded by Davis and Simmons, you know, it took a life of its own. It just went, everyone embraced the ideals, and it took a life of its own and really got out of the hands of Davis and Simmons, and it kind of left them in behind eventually. But the Klan was a good gravy train for a lot of people. You know, it was a lucrative business, really. That's why Clark and Taylor got involved. They got a cut of the initiation fees. And so that's what Davis was all about, was making money so he could do his promotion of the doctrine he wanted to promote across America. And of course, Simmons was accused of taking money, as we'll see, when they developed the Flaming Sword organization that crumbled pretty quickly. But so to accomplish that goal of what Davis and white Protestant America really wanted, and plus it was a vehicle that just lined the pockets of everyone that got involved. And so lucrative at the time. So eventually we find out that Davis and Simmons even lose control of the Klan to others, and it caused them to come together again. I believe it was in either Oklahoma. I think it was Oklahoma. And they formed another organization, which we'll talk about, Knights of the Flaming Sword. And it was a counter-Klan organization to counter-Klan and pull people out of the Klan, get them to join the Flaming Sword, so Davis and Simmons could continue what they wanted to start back in 1915, since the Klan had left them. Davis and Simmons, you know, flopped at trying to get that started, and eventually they had to abandon the idea. And Davis even began to accuse Simmons of wanting to hoard the money, and it was all about the money, and they just squabbled over that, and that really caused a lot of internal conflict and crumbled. So, you know, as I was preparing for today, you know, it became clear that Davis failed at creating a separate organization to promote his causes. But what he did find, I believe, what I see happening, there's a pivot point here. When he failed at the secret organizations, what he did was he found a way to promote his ideas through churches. He was doing that all along, but he especially went straight into religion and began promoting his white supremacy doctrine, you know, through the churches alone, you know, without... But he was still sympathetic to the Klan. He still supported the Klan all his life. And He was already doing that throughout Texas and Georgia, Tennessee, North and South Carolina. But the Klan really threw him out on his bad behavior, as we'll see. Got an article about that. They really just did not want him as part of the organization anymore, because the Klan was started for, you know, to bring in people of good moral character. And we know Davis was not a man of good moral character. So so eventually he hid behind the cloak of religion. He was pretended to be a man of the cloth. And it was at this juncture when he turned solely to religion in the 1920s. And you may have more ideas about this than I, more information about when him and Branham met up and started holding revivals together in Tennessee. But it was at this juncture he met, you know, William Branham, and then began to show him the ropes of all he was doing. You know, Davis was 19 years older than Branham and had already perfected, you know, his religious stage show. You know, Davis had been doing it a long time, and he began to show Branham how to do this. And outwardly, you know, Davis put on this air of piety, you know, everywhere he went, piety, holiness, following the old-time religion, which was mostly, he migrated into Pentecostalism at the time. But inwardly, you know, we will see that he's one of the most worst ravening wolves ever to rise up. And what surprised me so much when I found out who Branham's mentor was, and the public eventually found out in 1950 when he published that article, you know, in Voice of Healing. But how Branham was ever saved and received the Holy Ghost under his ministry is, you know, beyond me. And how Branham could even ever work for such a devil for several years is also beyond me. But it's a fact, I believe we can say for sure that, you know, Branham learned and honed his skills under Davis. And of course, Davis was a Pentecostal. And there's some things we'll get into the 1930s. I don't want to spoil it for our next episode. But Davis knew spiritualist tricks. You know, Davis knew how to do the reading of the minds and the hearts. He even, you know, was going to perform that on stage later on. So it was actually in the papers about it. So he also, I'm pretty sure he baptized in the name of Jesus Christ. He conducted healing revivals. People believed he healed the sick. And, you know, this is a man that was evil, and he was doing all these things. And supposedly, while him and Branham toured in Tennessee, and we'll have more information about that, he drank deadly poison and didn't even kill him while he was in a revival service. And Davis, of course, believed serpent seed way back in the 20s, you know, long before, you know, Branham preached it as his own doctrine, as a revelation. And he taught most every doctrine, really, Branham eventually preached. And so we'll see that. So I personally believe, you know, if Branham would have had any spiritual discernment about himself, you know, he would have run from Davis, you know, from the start. You know, Davis knew how to deceive people, how to get people to like him. You know, and William Branham was also a master at doing that. But I think what listeners will come away with today, if we have time, is we're going to cover 1924 to 1928 or 29. You know, Davis was transitioning through his calls from secret organizations and moved totally into the Christian religion and managed to deceive, you know, many as long as he stayed in that rank. But Branham and his message, I believe, was just an extension of his movement. You know, as they were planting churches, as they were going around the nation, you know, he was just, as Davis called him, he was his Timothy. And his Timothy did a very good job at deceiving a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into this one as well. And before we go there, there are two points that you mentioned that I think we need to stress and emphasize. You mentioned, number one, the spiritualism. This was, you know, Davis was thrilling the crowds by claiming that he had been a converted spiritualist, and Christians were coming to see this person who's now explaining the inner workings of spiritualism. And that was fascinating the crowds. The other thing you mentioned, which we've mentioned previously, was, you know, Clark and the money aspect of this. You have to understand the Klan was a social movement. When we think of social movements today, we think of, you know, the TikTok craze or the Facebook craze, etc. Well, back then, there was no internet, there was no television, and what these men did, they would hold lectures, and people would just go see a lecture like you might turn on a documentary today or even a sitcom, because some of these lectures were highly entertaining. And, you know, Davis and apparently Branham was in the lecture tours. They called it the Chautauqua, where they would go out and hold these stage acts, basically, but they were holding lectures. And this was a highly popular thing. Spiritualism in the United States was a fascinating craze. So when you take a social movement, which the Klan was, and you mix it with the most popular thing at the time, one of the most popular things, which is spiritualism, blend those two, and now mix in Davis, who's claiming to be a Christian, which I have a strong suspicion he was not, and you mix those three elements together, and if you're studying the NAR from the critical standpoint, you suddenly realize, wait a minute, that's exactly what they have today in many of these NAR churches. It's spiritualism mixed with social, mixed with money scheme, which is the other aspect. When you signed up for the Klan, when you signed up another person to join the Klan, you got approximately $10, which back then, that was a heck of a lot of money. And the more you signed up, obviously, the more money you got. Well, you had to pay your dues, and some of those dues went up to the higher levels. So you paid your dues, whoever signed you up got some, and then so on and so forth. Well, it was a pyramid scheme. The man at the top was making a heck of a lot of money. We're talking more money than we can fathom in today's in today's money. So again, look at the modern NAR, look at the money trail. Watch the money as it's flowing through these religions, and they're doing the same exact thing. It's not really religion, it's entertainment, and there is a strong motivation to financial motivation to do it. So all of this background that essentially is the Klan or was the Klan, all of this background is building to this theme that would suddenly become embedded in evangelical Christianity. I'm not saying that it was evangelical Christianity, you know, that existed prior, but now you had evangelical men and women who were going to these lectures and they were seeing this thing, many of them not knowing that the Klan was evil because this was a popular social movement. So they would join into the Klan, many of them. And the last point that I will make is when you think of the Klan, we've been polarized to think of them as just simply anti-black. But as a social movement that spread quickly across the United States, it spread so quickly that there were entire Klan organizations that did not know that they were supposed to be anti-black. And as a social movement, what it became is whatever was their number one enemy for their social groups, that was the Klan agenda. So you get up into, you know, like the state of Indiana was more anti-Catholic than it was anti-black. In the South, especially, there was this theme of race mixing. So they were highly anti-black in the South. They produced a lot of propaganda and rhetoric, painting race mixing as a purely evil thing that would destroy the nation. And if you look at the themes in Latter Rain, you can see that was predominantly any talk about race in Latter Rain was against race mixing, which came from the Klan. Then you get out west, and it's a whole different agenda because you had an influx of Hispanic people coming in from Mexico. They were actually anti-Mexican Klan groups out west. So you had this wide variety of people joining into this thing. And now, like you said, we enter the era where we don't know yet the exact point where William Branham meets up with Davis. It looks like it's going to be the early to mid 1920s, according to the picture of research that we're going to be showing. But essentially by 1929, the two are together and they're holding revivals in Tennessee. And like you said, the Knights of the Flaming Sword, that's going to play a big part into the history as we get into Indiana. So I'll save some of that, but all of this is setting up the picture where Davis is coming into an era where the things that he say about white supremacy are actually, the audience is very receptive to it.
Yeah, John, you said some things there that I'm going to emphasize maybe toward the end of this broadcast but, about the NAR. You know, when you bring in groups without a good doctrinal foundation in the scripture, you know, anything goes in. And it, their organization, and like you said, the roots of this thing come from what we're talking about. And it migrated, and there's so many different flavors of it, too. And like I say, that's why anything can go. Any group out there can start their own organization and embrace the ideas, but they can have their own flavor of it. And so we'll see a certain part of this has migrated into the NAR. The spiritual side of it, you know, really anything goes spiritually. You can, these men are not very doctrinally sound. And so you see the same things spiritually happening maybe in India in a totally different religion, you know, maybe the Kundalini religion, as you see happening in these circles that's supposed to be Christianity. So you wonder, you know, how can they both be this? They're probably the same spirit, but how can one be the Holy Spirit, one not, and be a devil? So you have to be very careful. And the NAR and groups like that that have embraced all these things, there's been so many things that's happened in the spiritual realm that very questionable, you know, in my opinion. And so I just wanted to say that. And it's because of not having a good doctrinal foundation, you know, in scripture, because, you know, you can basically promote anything you want to with the way these platforms go. Man can rise up and be like Davis even. I mean, there's some out there like that, and they've got a great healing ministry. You know, it's just unbelievable. But get back to Davis, you know, the timeline, say from 1917 to 21, real quickly. You know, he was arrested in May of 1917, swindling that bank in Texas. And you know, when he finally was arrested in 1917, the paper reported that he was a singer. You know, he was always a great singer, as we know. He was a masher and, you know, a minister. I looked up the word masher, and so let me just tell the audience what the word masher means. You can look it up. But it's a man who habitually makes aggressive, unwelcome sexual advances to women he does not even know with a view to physical intimacy. So the papers had him, you know, dead on. They identified exactly what he was, you know, even from the beginning. But they revealed his dual life in Georgia, and by this time, you know, he had a second wife. He was now 29 years old, and that would have put William Branham being about 10 years old. And I always go by, when I go by the birth dates, just for the record, is Davis, 1888. I know he used 1890 a lot, but there's other times on government documents he used 1888 and had to put his true birth date there. And William Branham, I used 1907. You know, to me, there was no doubt he was born in 1907. But the paper said Davis was a forceful speaker and a very intelligent. So there's no doubt, you know, he was very intelligent and sly. They said he had a handsome, open countenance, you know, which gave the impression of innocence. So just think about this as wolf in sheep clothing gave that impression of innocence, while his heavy auburn hair adds to his striking appearance. And it's little wonder and has been able to favorably impress the public wherever he's gone. So that's the rundown of Davis, you know, why he was able to, you know, sway the public, because everywhere he went, he was so handsome, he was a great singer, and he was just very good with the women. And a lot of times we'll find he gets the women behind him, and eventually it's the women that help him succeed, you know, whether it be in the courtroom or, you know, he even broke marriages up. There's I know of two cases. You know, there's one in Nashville where the man said he was trying to break up his marriage. So just terrible things. But his first wife, Emma, you know, divorced him in August of 1917 after all this came out in the papers. And then he continued to minister in Texas with his brothers, even in revivals. And then about 1917, you know, he's already in Georgia and had been going to Georgia, and that's where he had this other woman. So he returns to Georgia, and he takes the name of Lon Davis with his new wife. And this is also his new daughter was being born about this time. Let's see. I don't have the exact date when his new daughter was born, but I'll tell you this. by the dates, his second wife actually became pregnant in February of 1917. And this was, you know, 6 months prior to him divorcing Emma, his first wife. So this is kind of interesting. You know, he had already gotten a second woman with a child impregnated prior to even divorcing his first wife. So he was a dual man. You know, he had multiple women that he, you know, consorted with. And that's what led to the downfall of his first marriage. He was trying to keep them both together. I don't know how he can do that and live with himself and try to. So he resurfaces in 1919 in Georgia in January, a year later, after leaving Texas with those revivals. And then he announced a debate with a missionary Baptist minister debating the Church of Christ minister. So Davis had a habit of, he knew the doctrine very well, very intelligent. He had studied all the church doctrines. So he could take a position and then challenge another minister of another denomination whom he knew he had the differences with, and then challenge him to that debate. So in public eye, he could look like a very learned and scholarly man, eventually taking on the title of Dr. Davis to hold these debates. And then it made the other minister look kind of foolish because he knew the arguments that would bring the other minister down. Same way Branham did it, using baptism in the name of Jesus Christ throughout his ministry. And in almost all his sermons, he brings it up, condemns the denominations for not doing it, and seems to have a biblical argument for it. But if you could really dig deeper in scripture, you know, there was no certain formula, you know, and what baptism is all about is totally, you know, different than just using a certain formula. So Branham used that same strategy in his sermons. You know, he didn't challenge people to debates so much as he did. His sermon was his debate platform.
That's an interesting way to put it. The sermons were the debate platform. I think that, you know, as you look through the weaponization of religion, that really became the premise for everything that we see today, where Christians, you know, used to go to hear the gospel and to learn how to be a better example and to attract people into Christianity by living a good example through the gospel. That changed with the birth of the Klan and Davis's weaponization of religion. It was very much a debating platform because Davis himself was a debater. He would go on these tours for lectures, like I said, which was highly popular. The other thing that was popular were the debates, and he would debate all things. We have records of him debating religion, and especially when he gets into oneness Pentecostalism, he's holding debates on the Pentecostal faith, etc. He was staging debates where he and William Joseph Simmons were scheduling debates where they would go and defend the Klan, etc. And so what happened was the popularity of the debates brought people to fill the audience. Well, mixing that with religion, now he can build a bigger audience of Christians who are going to put tithes in the tithe basket by debating in his sermons. And he, you know, we have records of this. If you go onto the website and you just type in Roy Davis, go to the newspaper, you can see some of the titles of his sermons and even some sermon content. One of the things that struck me is when he came into Louisville, Kentucky, which is the heart of bourbon country, right? This is where Al Capone used to come and hide out in the secret labyrinths underneath Louisville as he's doing his wheeling and dealing to get alcohol. Well, Davis comes here and he says that he's preaching against the people who are fighting for prohibition because he feels it's wrong, yet he also was against alcohol. So he creates this conundrum of doublespeak, and he says that he paints the scene of a church service wherein the women come in, just fall off their feet drunk, and they're sitting in the laps of men inside of the church service. Now, this would have been during the time when William Branham, the leader of the, you know, the Healing Revival, was his either assistant pastor or an elder in the church. So at that point in time, there were, according to Davis, a you know, just wild ruckus of drunk people in the church. And that would have been controversial. So you would have had debates about, well, you shouldn't be doing this, man. Let them, you know, keep the drunk people out. Let it be a sober church service. But that's how things were. He wanted the controversy. And I think that's the last key element that I'll focus in, is the controversy brings argument. And there is really no bad publicity. So if you can create people arguing with each other, they're talking about whatever it is that you have to say. And Davis realized the power of that. You know, you mentioned Singer, Masher, these are all entertainment things. Well, the debate was an entertainment thing back then. When we think of debate today, like, I don't know that I would go pay to see a debate, but back then people actually did, because there was no television. There was no movies were coming, films were coming in, you know, but by and large, their primary form of entertainment were these lectures, debates, and sermons. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, Davis loved controversy and he didn't shy away from it. Debating was his strategy. And we'll even see that, you know, Branham early on, you know, tried the debate strategy of 1950. You know, but I think that was his only public debate that he ever had. But he really didn't. He wasn't much of a debater. I guess he used Bosworth as his main debater to tell the scriptures, because you know, Branham wasn't very schooled in the scriptures. He was very much a novice, very shallow in the scriptures. I've got another comment about that later on. But all these speakers, these circuit riding preachers and revivalists, they were powerful speakers. All these men were very gifted in the public eye. I mean, they had talents. And Davis was a strong student of doctrine. He knew these doctrines of various churches. And, you know, Branham was also very learned in the doctrines of denominational churches, just the ones he wanted to make the argument with. And his debate platform, which was primarily when he got into Trinitarianism, you know, shying away from that, getting into the oneness, and holding on to that, he would always put down the Trinitarians. And the same thing with baptism, same thing with women's dress, anything he could hold over the heads of other churches and call them out for it, he would do it. And he just was doing that about every sermon. It really didn't go a long ways to saving souls. It went a long way to keeping people in line, conforming to the rules, and also condemning other churches and trying to make his look right. But he learned this strategy from Davis, and most all of his doctrine, you know, I believe came from Davis, because really we learned from a quote that Branham had that the serpent seed actually came from Davis's church early on. He admitted that when he discussed serpent seed with even George Dearc, when he attended Davis's church, and you know, water baptism is the same way. I think in the newspapers, Davis was publishing that he was baptizing in the name of Jesus. So Branham's strategy was to use doctrines like that to condemn all the other churches. And that's how he was able to pull away and say he was something unique, you know, from any other minister in the nation, and call the other churches apostate, you know, for not practicing it that way. So he taught unique doctrines, you know, and Branham did. We'll just interject this. You know, they would sound somewhat scriptural, like serpent seed, and then convince followers it was some new revelation from an angel, and then start condemning other churches about it. So he did that with everything. You know, Roy's strategy was to take a side, you know, any side, because he took both sides. He, You know, he joined up with the Pentecostals. He was the Baptist, Church of Christ, Church of God. It didn't matter what sect he was in at the time and who he was trying to, you know, gather under his wing. You know, he would pick a battle, and he knew he had a good chance of winning, you know, in any argument he took. So he sided with a lot of different churches. So he really never held towards any one particular doctrine, because he could take any side he wanted to. If he won the debate, then of course his following would grow. That's what, you know, gave him more followers, was by winning that debate, because it made him look bigger in the public eye. And, you know, that's the same way, you know, Branham would do as well.
Growing the following is another point that will come into focus largely when we get, you know, a little bit further along. The NAR, if you study its history and its origins, it was spawned off from the church growth movement, which was the notion that in order to sway the American public political social opinion, we needed large churches with mass persuasion. And that grew into the NAR, these, you know, these themes of mega churches. Well, Davis was trying to do the same thing, but for different reasons. There was a lot of money in it. Well, I said different reasons, but if you look at the NAR, that may be the same theme too. But specifically, Davis was looking to make more money. That was really his agenda. And whenever you think about $10 a head to sign people up, that's not even the full extent of the money. You had to purchase the Klan robes. You had all of these different symbolisms that you could buy in the forms of various items that they sold. And I think the estimate was like 20 something dollars for every single Klan recruit. And all that money, again, it's in a pyramid scheme. So as it's coming up through Davis and he has to pay his dues, he's making money and he's sitting sort of at the top of this thing. So not only is he making the money for people he signs up, there may be, I don't know how many layers of levels of different people under his area in the pyramid. So he is wanting it to grow exponentially. He wants massive organizations, to the extent that by the time we get into the era that we're talking about, you know, as we're leading into his time in Tennessee prior to his coming to Louisville and Jeffersonville, Indiana, Davis has decided that he's going to start his own organization. And how that comes into play is a story for probably another episode, but he wants to become much like John Alexander Dowie, where he's creating a movement that is Catholic. And when I say Catholic, I don't mean like the Roman Catholic Church. The word Catholic just simply means universal, the universal church. Davis wants to create something where everybody's welcome. All are welcome. And when you think of the healing revivals, that was the theme that was carried forward. They called it an interdenominational movement. So Davis created the framework for an interdenominational movement. And all of it, when you study everything about Davis, it all comes back down to the money.
Yeah, I think money is a driving force behind a lot of these ministers, as we know today, even televangelists today. Money is the driving force. And, you know, money, the Bible says money answers all things. The love of money is the root of all evil. And so it's very clear, you know, the evangelists, televangelists today, they love money. I mean, there's just no doubt. That's their primary focus. They're trying to convince their followers. Today, now it's morphed into how much money you can get if you give me your money, and how much God's going to bless you by you blessing me. So that's just what it's morphed into. But with the NAR, you know, they're focused on, they can accept just about anything, and all these groups can come together because no one's got any sound doctrine about them, so they can't stand for anything. So they have to accept, you know, other beliefs and the way people do things. So they can all come together in a unique way. Whereas if you had sound doctrine, it would kind of separate, you know, and at least, you know, you would stay somewhat with the truth versus having these aberrant belief systems. But so getting back to Davis, you know, in 1920, you know, Davis was pastoring in Acworth and Adairsville, Georgia. So now he's kind of gotten established, pastoring two churches, actually. And the Klan was gaining its momentum. as a social organization, like you said, you know, people were joining it, not realizing it was underlying, had a lot of hatred towards other groups. It was just a social thing to do. It was gaining political power very rapidly. You know, politicians were joining. You know, when Upshaw was a member, I believe it went into the police force because they needed the police force to allow them to get by with some of these lynchings and things they were doing to, you know, black people and the hatred they were displaying. So some of the vigilante justice, some of the, you know, evil things they were doing, you know, if they had the police force and policemen behind them, they just turned their head. Even mayors of town, the towns there, you know, were probably involved. So the political power, you know, was a secret organization and they were gaining, you know, their structure. Davis was also, again, editor of an Adairsville newspaper, and he used that platform to promote the political candidates that he wanted to promote that supported the Klan. And he would also denounce others that didn't support the Klan. And Davis used the paper to condemn Roman Catholics and others that the Klan was against. So Davis knew very well the power of the press and continued to do that throughout everywhere he went. So by February 1921, you know, the suspicion of the Klan kind of grew in the nation, where congressmen were being alerted that this might not be a good organization for America. And by July of 1921, you know, Roy was exposed at the Ackworth Baptist Church where he was pastor. You know, they found out he was recruiting for the Klan and actually having meetings at the church, you know, secretly, you know, with Klan members. He was also discovered that he was using an alias, you know, and having two wives and being divorced from his first wife, skipping paying his bills and honest debts even, and accused of bank fraud. After all this came out in July, Ackworth Baptist Church ousted him, and then he leaves town. And then from there, he goes into Oklahoma. So in August, we see him surfacing in Oklahoma in Idaville. And it's about 100 miles from his hometown of Paris, Texas. So he kind of, you know, turned tail and ran, you know, for a while. And so he spent time out there as a missionary Baptist pastor, held revival meetings, assisted by his brothers. You know, he called his brother everywhere he went. When he got into trouble, he kind of called his brothers as a, you know, security detail to kind of surround him and support one another while they ministered. They did the same thing in Jeffersonville, you know, each woman having their own churches, but they always worked together. The paper reports him as being recognized in several states as one among the ablest and successful preachers of his denomination. You know, the papers, Davis had a habit of submitting articles to papers to publish about him. So he was always published in favorable press, you know, about himself, even though he came from a very, you know, bad background, a very dark past, and the papers usually didn't know about it. It was information that traveled as fast back then. But he began a campaign at that time of sending threatening letters to those that opposed him in Texas and Georgia. So now he was trying to attack his enemies who exposed his bad life. He was now attacking them. And the Klan was founded on requiring members to exhibit moral behavior. So things were starting to turn on Davis there. The Klan was very much about protecting womanhood. So what Davis did in getting a second wife, divorcing his first wife, was very contrary to the ideals of the Klan. And so by now, the Klan was exposing his immoral behavior. And that's why he was writing his threatening letters. So his behavior started being exposed. And we'll see in a little bit, if I can get to it, what they eventually did to him. By 1921 in October, you know, Congress Upshaw enters the picture, you know, for the first time in our research, I believe. And it shows his connection with Simmons and Davis and Upshaw. That connection was established. Simmons, you know, welcomed the publicity. You know, Congress was threatening to investigate the Klan. I think it was October that time that Simmons had to go to Washington while Congress was investigating. And Congress wanted to know all the members, you know, all the names. And it's very interesting. This was a very strategic move by Upshaw, but it shows the very, you know, Upshaw, how smart he was. He saves the day with a strategic move of equal protection under the law. So he said in Congress, He said, you either investigate, you know, all secret societies at this time, or you investigate none of them. Don't just pick on the Klan. But Upshaw being a member, of course, he didn't want it to be known that he was a member. But and Upshaw was very much for Davis and Simmons. And Congress actually agreed with that because many of the congressmen were probably members of secret societies themselves, such as the Masons, might be, you know, Knights of Columbus, whoever, you know, they were members of, and they didn't want to be, you know, brought out as well, because they'd have to do it to all if they do it to one. And so that was very interesting that happened. So the congressional investigation didn't go very far. You know, I tell you, Simmons welcomed that publicity about he wasn't afraid at all to go up there. He wasn't about the violent aspect of the Klan at that time, but it was starting to gain momentum in the violent aspect. But while Davis was in Idaville, you know, he wrote articles in the newspaper all the time, very clear denouncing interracial marriage in February 1922, after he'd been writing articles for a year and getting people behind him. Then he very clearly denounced interracial marriage. So he started really showing his colors. And, you know, he started out with religion and under that cloak and seeming like a nice minister. But then he starts showing his true colors. And he starts bringing out that and the Klan ideas. He even said in the paper, believe it or not, he said there's too many mulattoes in this country. And it's very clearly written in the newspapers. And so by March of 1922, he basically went traveling again, went deep into Oklahoma, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Georgia after that article appeared, and then started holding KKK lectures. So after he got established in a church, as we've seen, he's done it multiple times, got established in Idaville, Oklahoma. Then he starts traveling. Then he starts spreading he does KKK lectures. In late 1922, he returns to Georgia to promote the Klan again. So he tries this. He always wants to go back to Georgia, and he did that for a time, trying to stay in Georgia, but he eventually was ousted altogether. But Klan membership was skyrocketing at that time, approaching a few million members. And Davis is in Albany, Decatur, and South Georgia at this time. You know, he was already being exposed around Atlanta area. So then he moves into South Georgia, you know, and starts his campaign there.
You mentioned so many elements of history there that if you really take the sum of all of them and you think about what they are and what these men were doing, this represents the full scenario of how religion can be weaponized. When you think about Davis, who is clearly an evil person who is not representing the good morals of society, but he's presenting himself as a Christian minister who is spreading morals of society. And he's doing many things that are unethical and even illegal with women. And he's touting himself as the, you know, the Klan touted themselves as the protector of womanhood, as you said. Well, he is not protecting. He's actually a predator, right? And then combine that with the fact that the newspapers are painting him as this hero. Well, there's this really gray area, because while some newspapers were fully unaware that Davis was this villainous character, there were other newspapers that actually knew that he was one of the bad guys, but he was furthering the cause. And so they saw it as a, you know, even though this character is not a good person, they saw what he's doing as being good. And when you compare that to the NAR today, and I won't give any names, but you look at some of the men that have, now they're being exposed for being predators for women in their churches. And we're talking big name people in the NAR. People are now realizing that these are not good men. These were predators. And yet, at the same time, there were many other leaders in the NAR who completely were aware that this thing was going on. In fact, some of them are now starting to talk. But because he was preaching the NAR agenda, they saw it as a good thing, even though they knew probably he was going to fall. Well, that was the way in which they worked. The other thing, you mentioned Upshaw and painting the picture of all of these fraternal organizations, and everybody's probably part of this. Well, a lot of these congressmen, they knew that the Klan was doing very, very bad things. They were actually killing people in some areas. And it wasn't that the Klan promoted the killing of people. It was that they had such a social agenda that excited the weaker-minded people who would go out and do bad things. So it wasn't that they were pushing for this, but they knew that the framework of their doctrinal positions was causing destructive theologies to emerge and destructive people to become killers. That's how bad this was. But it was an acceptable risk because they saw the Klan as this Americanization. They were true Americans. They were trying to fight for true Americanism. And one of the ways in which they created that distinction for their group is that they would put out propaganda polarizing the people against whatever was their position. For example, one of the things that they did, they reassured the nation that the Klan would fight to protect the Christian morals of the country, and they slipped in this phrase, and 14 million people of the colored race who were organizing. So it was like a sleight of hand, right? We're going to protect the nation, and then associated with that in your mind are, oh my gosh, are the African Americans in America actually organizing against us? Are they rising up? Well, that just dominated through, you know, especially in the South, that dominated through politics. So it was this agenda where they could paint themselves as the good guys, even though they weren't. They could create a problem that really didn't exist and then polarize people to fight that problem that did not exist. And again, you take that up to, you know, through history to the NAR today, that's largely what they've done from a religious standpoint. They polarize the people against Christians who aren't part of this NAR thing and who do not accept the political, religious, moral, and social elements of the NAR. And they spread propaganda of things that are happening in American society that really is not the case. There may be some extreme versions that closely resemble it, but they're mimicking exactly what Davis was trying to do and how he did it.
They just have to be very careful about who they're following and who they're relying on for their, you know, doctrine and spiritual food. But as you mentioned, that weak-minded people, I think there's a lot of people that can allow themselves to get caught up in mob mentality, the frenzy of the moment, and that's how that some of these lynchings probably occurred, or the violence probably occurred. People just take it and run with it to the extreme, and they don't have any. They're not doing any forethought about what the consequences are and what they're doing. So, and these talented men that get up there, that are even predators, as you said, they can just deceive people. And we're seeing it come out in the news even now. And they're very prominent people and very high ranking people in the NAR actually, before the public, before the congregation there, ordained some of these men and called them prophets and, mighty men to carry on the army of Joel, or whoever, for this end time revival that they keep speaking of. And then they turn out to be devils. They turn out to have had affairs and leave their wives. And it's just an embarrassment to the group when they've just have ordained them before the public. And endorse them before the public. So, and some of these things carry on a long time, as we've seen in the news recently, that you brought out, and so Davis was no different, in that respect. And I just go back and say, well, how could a man that God's supposed to have, brought to this earth as a prophet of God, say in the last day, could ever have worked with a man like Davis without some discernment beyond me? But getting back to Davis, in January 1923, they worked together. They were working together again very closely, and the newspapers reported they were denied a venue. And now they were starting to gain national attention, and this is what eventually led to the downfall of Davis in Georgia. But there were newspapers from Texas, Arkansas, Montana, even New York to Florida, newspapers all over reported this one thing, that they were denied the use of a speaking engagement, a hall where they wanted to promote the Klan. And that was in January of 1923. About this time in February, Davis in South Georgia starts a newspaper called the Brickbat, and that's in Meigs, Georgia, or in South Georgia, if you look it up. He also became president of the Georgia Farmers Union, and then pastored, you know, multiple churches at this time still. So Davis was making his inroads back to Georgia, having come back from Oklahoma. The Oklahoma newspapers kind of go silent. I guess he leaves other men in charge of the churches he started there. So it only took a few months. And Davis is, you know, notorious for this. He writes something in the paper about somebody else, and he gets accused of libel by a woman of Valdosta, Georgia. And then he was arrested. This was in June of 1923, after he started that newspaper, The Brickbat. And less than a few days later, his fateful day came. His whole life was exposed by the newspaper. So after this came out, nationwide, coast to coast, if you go look at the newspapers, I counted 22 different newspapers in July, from July 1st to July 28th. That exposed the story and carried the story. It just got picked up by the Nation. Probably the AP picked it up, and every newspaper carried it. It was a pretty big deal. You know, he lost his Brickbat paper at the time. He lost his pastorate at Valdosta. He was fired from the Farmers Union after all this came out. And basically his career in Georgia was over by July of 1923 after all this came out. And this is kind of funny. You know, and this is where the Klan is beginning to turn against Davis, because even the Klan couldn't stand him eventually. So in August of 1923, after this came out, and he just kind of lost everything in Georgia, he went back to Texas. And while he was in Texas, he was flogged, you know, with a wet rope for his bad conduct, which left him hospitalized right after that, I guess, with scars on his back. So even the Klan began to hate Davis and oust him in August. So there was an article in the paper about that. And they called him Lon Davis, but they said he was known to be the same Roy Davis, you know, that had all these issues. So in September, after he recovered from his wounds, you know, he came back to Georgia. And believe it or not, in Fitzgerald, Georgia, he began to pastor another church. You know, how he stuck back in Georgia after all that exposure, I don't know, but he just had a way of doing it. So he began to pastor the Kennedy Memorial Baptist Church in Fitzgerald, and he holds services, and he tells all services, the members in the Baptist Church, he gives a sermon called My Life as a Klansman, Why I'm No Longer Working with the KKK. So this is where he makes his break, you know, so-called with the KKK, and probably because he was a little sore over what had happened to him in Texas. But at some point, the pressure was mounting against Davis to where he probably feared for his life. He actually began carrying a gun for protection. He was arrested in January of 1924, just a few months later, in Fitzgerald, Georgia, for carrying a gun. It says he was placed under bond. He was charged with carrying a deadly weapon concealed and also carrying a deadly weapon in a place of worship. So even before concealed weapons were allowed, as we do today, we're carrying him in churches again, and he was carrying his weapon in church services, it says. It was being alleged by a person that he had a pistol concealed on one occasion last June at the Kennedy Memorial Church, and so he was given a $200 bond. The Klan had outed David from membership around February 1924 officially. By Hiram Evans, who, you know, like we said in the last episode, that Hiram Evans got the membership, got the leadership of the Klan under him and bought out Simmons, you know, with a salary and a title. But Hiram Evans, that dentist from Texas, actually took control of the Klan. So Hiram published this in the papers about ousting Davis for good. He said, by the authority and power vested in me, under the constitutional laws of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan Incorporated, hereby banish Roy E. Davis from membership in the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan depriving him of all rights to appear before any duly authorized and chartered or provisional clan body throughout the bounds of the Invisible Empire. You know, they do it for cause. He's guilty of acts and offenses against the clan. And they go on and mention all those acts that he did. So that was a pretty good pivotal point there in February 1924. It was by him being flogged by the Klan that they knew what he was about. They finally just ousted him altogether. And that begins the relationship of Davis and Simmons in forming the new organization, which we'll talk about, you know, pretty soon.
As it relates to our overall story, this is the key moment, right? The Klan in the United States is declining because Simmons, as we'll talk about in the next episode, Simmons is being exposed as the head of this pyramid scheme, of which many leaders in it are not upholding the moral values that they presented. And so there's a shift that happens, and that shift goes towards Indiana. And Indiana suddenly becomes the proving ground for white supremacy, and it's a different flavor of white supremacy, but it's also becoming the most profitable, which we'll also get into in the next episode. And so Davis and Simmons try to create something new. It, you know, as we'll talk about, it doesn't really work out, but where they went with this, with the religion / white supremacy, I have to say, even though it's kind of been underground history for a long time because it's been covered up, I think this was actually far more effective than what they did with the Klan when you think about how religion was weaponized by these guys. And you mentioned the flogging. I'll never forget, I was working with a historian. We were studying Davis's connection to the Kennedy assassination, the things that were happening in the social environment there in Dallas leading up to the assassination, which Davis was a key part of. And we were doing this research, and he found that article and sent it to me about the flogging. And he says, this is Texas justice. And the thought struck me because in the, you know, in the Latter-Rain and the Branham cults, et cetera, there's some very horrific things that are said in the sermons. And your mind is so manipulated that you really don't critically think about how bad they are. But one of the things Branham is talking about, how the way he would do it is he would not come out and instruct the bad thing. He would instead create a fictional story and say that the fictional story was a good thing. And he talks about how a woman was beating the daughter until she was so bruised and swollen that she could not put clothes over her. And he says, and that's what we need to do today. And when this guy sent me this flogging article, which is kind of a funny story about Davis, I thought, well, that's what needs to happen today, a flogging of these bad guys, which is wrong. You know, I shouldn't think like that. I realize now that was wrong. But the irony of it is just unbelievable, because Branham's mentor, Davis, was actually flogged and beaten to, you know, I want to say it was so bad he was hospitalized, if I remember correctly. So the mentor of the guy who's saying that we should beat children until they can't actually, we should beat them without clothes until they can't put the clothes back on after we beat them, his mentor was flogged. So the irony is just unbelievable. But really excited to get into the next episode. You can kind of see my face lighting up now that we've got the backstory for this. This is going to really start going into some very fun stuff. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more information about Roy Davis and William Branham, you can read The Persuasive Preacher, The Gifted Prophet, and The Noble Politician. For more information about the dark side of Latter-Rain, read Weaponized Religion from Latter-Rain to Colonia Dignidad, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.